This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, and I'm joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. You're Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. It was good to see you last week.
It was so nice to see you guys, and I love that my new job takes me to Dunedin so often, so I get to see more of you guys, which makes me happy.
So you're just back from Canada. I'm just back from Italy. Who are we introducing today?
We are today interviewing the very lovely intrepid journeyer, Mr. Steve Henry. Welcome, Steve. It's wonderful to have you here.
Oh, kia ora, kia ora. It's beautiful to be here. Thanks.
Welcome, Steve. Where are you, Steve?
I'm in Boston, Massachusetts, USA right now, and at the end of a three-week work trip. I've been over in Canada for most of that time, and now I'm in Boston for five days at a conference with 12,000 people at it, which is quite overwhelming, to be frank. But the learning has been phenomenal. Yeah.
So we'll work backwards, shall we? So what conference is it?
It's the Academy of Management conference. So it's a thing where people who are involved in management from around the world come, and it is the most significant multinational conference I've ever been to. There's people from every continent, apart from Antarctica. I haven't found anyone from there, but I was surprised how many people from Africa and Asia and are here, which is adding so much value. And I sat at a table yesterday with a woman from Dunedin, from the University of Otago, and when we went around the room and introduced ourselves, we went hi. It was funny, everyone laughed. Yeah, so it was great.
Academy of Management sounds a bit serious for you, Steve.
Well, it is a pretty earnest, and most of these people are very earnest, and it's been driven by the US university system, where people are either trying to get tenure for their roles or they're finishing their doctorates and are wanting to find jobs. And this whole idea of you earn permanency in these universities by publishing, and it's kind of like quite ridiculous. So it's quite interesting to look at it from our perspective and go, wow, it's so transactional, and it's just not about the relationships at all. It's about what you pump out. So it's been very curious to have a look at what we do and how we do it, and what it means to be a New Zealander and what that means in this context here.
Is it that's what you've learned? You've actually learned more about yourself than particular things that you've picked up? Or is it a bit of both?
Oh, look, I think there's many levels to unpack this. I mean, I think I could start by saying that I feel more grounded in my practice. I realize now the audience of my work is far bigger than I imagined. Like we're presenting tomorrow morning, actually, we haven't yet, but we have created quite a buzz by daring to talk about learner agency and suggesting that classrooms are not as required as they used to be. So most of these people, teach to 200 or 300 students at bachelor, master's, and even their doctorate level, they have classes. It's kind of like, so we're kind of going, wow, we're customizing what we do for individual learners, and it's a very different paradigm. So starting to talk the language of the paradigms, and that's been very well received, actually. And not that there's any, not that ours is better than anyone else's, but it's just different, right? So coming from this angle of, well, why is it like that? And for many, it's just incomprehensible that you can customize a degree learning program for individuals rather than for groups, or a curriculum where a learner gets to co-construct it is just news for them. So, that's been a big learning.
It is better, really.
Well, it's more agentic for everybody. And I, you know, that's what we realize, is that we have the freedom as academics to work out how to best support a learner in their context. We listen, and then we, as opposed to, hey, I'm the expert, I think I know, so you're going to follow this curriculum. That's kind of ludicrous. So, yeah, I've learned a lot. I mean, I think I've learned an awful lot about being an ally. You know, it's really helped me with my understanding of being a Pākehā New Zealander, that really to the idea of a polar Māori and Pākehā bicultural relationship for me, I've realised that when that's a very strong node, it's quite brittle. And I've come to see that if we can build weaker nodes around that and support those nodes, it will then take away this narrative of one or other, or this polarization, if that makes sense. So I've come to see that, and that happened in Canada in particular, where we had a fair bit to do with Indigenous people during our research boot camp that I was a part of helping facilitate. So that was a really neat experience to come and look. And I bought a new book called Becoming an Ally. Here it is. Look, it's a wonderful book, because I've been looking for something to explain this to me that's not in the New Zealand context, if that makes sense, because I can read this with respect to being a Pākehā New Zealander, a sixth generation New Zealand European New Zealander, but now I look at this from a different lens and go, this is how they see it, and it makes me realize what we are doing well and perhaps what I could do better as an ally.
Yeah. So before Boston, you were in Toronto?
Yeah, Toronto, yeah. Or as the locals say, Toronto. You drop the T's if you're really cool. We learned that. So we were kind of pushing that to its limit. And in Toronto, we met Ginger Rogers from Humber College and also her team. And we've been, and as well as two people from Denmark who came over, who we've been researching with for 2 years now, around this concept of learner agency in each of our contexts. So in Denmark right now, the European Union funding beyond 2026 for polytechnics and universities is depending on your ability to argue that you are delivering agents, that learners have an agentic component of what you deliver. So it's a very positive step, but they're all terrified because they don't know what it means. So a couple of years ago, we began exploring this, and because we do customized learning at Capable New Zealand, where I work, for learners, this is news to them, and they're very interested in that. And similarly, we're really interested in the way that I've learnt the Danish system has very much. So what we do is the limiting factor in what we do, we have these individuals who want to thrive and we help expand them. When we come up against our institutional structures, which are quite dogmatic and fixed in many ways, and they have their rigidities. And whereas what I've learnt about Denmark is that they have very soft structures. And actually staff have a lot of flexibility. So, for example, they don't have a formal ethics process, but they trust their professional staff to deliver ethical research without having oversight from committees the way we do. So that's just a wee example. They also do things like they have in the Danish and the Scandinavian learning traditions, they have this concept of becoming. So as well as whatever subject you're studying or area of endeavor you're working on, there is an assumption that you are becoming more of yourself as you learn. And there's some Danish words for that, which I won't do justice to. But so it's been very interesting to explore what that means and to understand how the structures are the limiting thing, often not the learner, for us. So I think about our assessing process. We give our learners in Capable New Zealand a lot of flexibility around their chosen case studies or their area of expression in their portfolios of evidence, which they submit as experienced practitioners to get a degree. But we come up against this thing called assessment, where there's rubrics and there's sort of some quite dogmatic fixed views that some more traditional assessors think that they're the expert in assessment, so they're sitting there making a judgment, rather than listening to the learner making a claim for their endeavor. And so this is, you know, where does the power sit? And it's a really interesting thing and the Canadians sit somewhere in the middle. You know, they've come to very neoliberal policies, and they've been essentially research is optional for all their academic staff at Humber College. So they're trying to build a research culture, whereas both Denmark and ourselves have a strong research culture. Anyone who delivers at degree level has to be researching. So it's a fascinating blend of these people from different places having a conversation about what's important to them and what matters and what the invisible structures are behind what we do. So it's helped me see more visibly what are our invisible structures, and such as the risk of becoming more transactional and less relational. So I think one of the great things we do in as we work with individual learners is that we're very relational with them. We get to know them, we're very personal with them, and we understand really carefully why they choose to do what they're doing. Whereas when it becomes more transactional, right, let's audit your abilities as a manager, for example. If you lead with that, you don't start with the relationship. And I learned at the research boot camp, we had 9 different countries represented, 40 people. And they were all quite mature. You know, there were a lot of mature learners there in their sort of late 20s rather than early 20s, say. Relatively mature as far as audiences go, but not, you know, there were a few 40-year-olds. But what I learned was that when we put a lot of effort into understanding people's culture before we got into the act of teaching about research. So, you know, we had people from Bhutan, Kenya, Spain, Taiwan, Japan. Very different Canada, and there were no Canadians, ironically, in Canada. And it was fascinating to. And there were Thai, there's some Thai learners there too. So it was really interesting to, each of those had different expectations around what a boot camp would look like. Some of them wanted us to just tell them how to do it because that's all they were used to. And of course, we refused to do that. We're going, we want to learn about you before we do anything. And they're going, why do you want to know about us? We want to learn about research. And it's like, well, as you'll see, research is embedded in your perspective. And we want to honor wherever you've come from, whatever your truth is, tell us what's important to you. And it really went beautifully. And interestingly, the Canadians were quite used to death by PowerPoint, you know, lots of PowerPoint, lots of that sort of stuff. And whereas we came from New Zealand going, right, we're going to workshop this with continuums. Let's move our bodies. Let's play card games to explain our practice. Let's do really interactive things. So it was a wonderful blend of, and the facilitation team were a combination of Canadians and myself and Henk Root, who's another New Zealander. It was a very rich experience to get out of our bubble. Yeah. So I'm talking a lot, so I don't know if you've got questions, please.
No, but I'm going to squeeze in the first of your music choices. Let's have Pātihi Māori Club with what Trevor Mallard described as what should be New Zealand's national anthem. Poi, why this one?
Oh, look, it just gives me goosebumps every time it comes on. And ever since it was played at the Rugby World Cup Women's Final, and just I saw that crowd rocking at Eden Park. It's worth watching it on YouTube if you've never seen it. It's just such an inspiring song, and it feels like it's tapped into the rich vein of what we stand for in this country to me.
Oh,
Steve, before when you were talking about becoming, it reminded me of a little part of a book that I absolutely love called The Velveteen Rabbit by Marjorie Williams Bianco. Are you familiar with the story?
No, I'm not.
Oh my gosh, you have to read it. You'd love it. But cool. It's a conversation between a rabbit and a skin horse, and the skin horse says to the, they're talking about the process of being real. And the skin horse said, it doesn't happen all at once. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't really happen for people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have been carefully kept. Generally, by the time you're real, most of your hair has been loved off, your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you're real, you can't be ugly except to people who don't understand. And I absolutely love that section of that book, because it really defines the process of professional practice, that development through experience. You know, we have to go out into the world and learn and experience, and we carry that with us. And then in Capable, it's been amazing to be able to go through that process of then taking all of that and gaining a tohu from it, a qualification that says that, you know, that you know this stuff, that you have become, that you are real. Is there a movement for that, do you think, in the practice space, especially in the traditional universities?
Well, you know, at the Academy of Management, there were some big hitters there, like quite famous people who apparently have you know, got 250,000 citations on their papers and all this sort of stuff, who were, you know, they were giving plenaries. And we were, and the big thing we noticed was they were suddenly, you know, the biggest keynote was about serendipity in learning and in organizations. And it's like, you know, and there were 10 experts came along, you know, from Harvard and Penn State and all these big places in America where everyone goes, well, you're a professor there, you must know stuff. And That what was really interesting, I mean, they were really wonderful people, but they were saying things like, how do we test diversity? Question mark. You know, they were asking, how can we tell if an organization's diverse in their thinking, right? How do we, and then, you know, they're saying, you know, a guy named Daniel Levithan, he said organizations do best when they engineer serendipity. Which is about, you know, I take to mean providing the space for things to, or give luck a chance, was talk about, you know, and, you know, which was the famous quote from Shackleton after he survived in the ice. And, you know, one of a woman from Amy Edmondson from Harvard, she talked about how oyster sauce got invented in 1888. A guy left a pot full of oysters on boiling by mistake, and it condensed right down to make oyster sauce overnight. And instead of just throwing it out, frustrated that he'd done that, he tasted it and just went, oh, my goodness. So oyster sauce was invented, and she said it's resulted in a $17 billion company since 1888, that because of that mistake that was quite simple, you know, a moment of serendipity that he didn't just go past. The key is to stop and pause and have the psychological safety to examine, you know, and you can look at penicillin, you can look at all of these so-called mistakes in inverted commas, which have often led to significant breakthroughs. And I learned another thing, which is most innovations actually occur from existing innovations rather than, and often they're from the thing you least expect. So one of the examples is Amazon's, you know, they were going to be a book and e-commerce place, and suddenly they got into the cloud, and, you know, they've made most of their money in operating in the cloud, and they never expected that. So I find this stuff very curious and interesting. So, I mean, the other really important thing is I'm in the last stages of my doctorate completion. So I was able to have many conversations with people about what I had, how my reframing and to get to simplicity with what I was doing. And I guess the big point I learned was these people are actually my audience.
Yeah.
It was me thinking it was New Zealand academics or people, you know, but actually there's a whole world of people who are really interested in learner agency and transformation. And that language is being used a lot. And that's my audience. And suddenly it's like, wow, it's very motivating and inspires me to do better for everybody who might encounter what I'm on about.
One of the other things that you talked about in the first section of the show today was being a good ally. Something that I've been pondering lately is this observation I've been making in our Aotearoa context, that we've moved through the ally, I think we've moved through the ally thinking, and we've come out the other end as collaborators, where there's actual action happening as a result of this change in the relationship. And that we're seeing that a lot with the Julian Batchelor people and their wander around Aotearoa with this very negative anti-Māori attitude that they have. But there are so many non-Māori who are protesting that, who say that that's the past, we need to move on. So that, that ally has become the collaborator. Are you seeing that as well?
Oh, I absolutely am seeing that in my practice. But I would argue it's not just in Aotearoa. I mean, we have people here, you know, one of the main themes of this conference was how can people learn to be more inclusive, essentially? And so how can you overcome these traditional biases we've had around gender, race, and, you know, disability, and actually say, look, if we can work with those things, they provide way more value than dismissing them as inferior. Or so actually, there's a lot of mainstream debate about how best to operate inclusive organisations, or how best to become gender. So gender becomes no longer an issue. And also, I think the race debate is still pretty hot here in the US, is what I notice, that it's, that there's a lot of people who are talking about this, but don't quite know how to overcome that polarized positioning. So rather than what can we learn from each other, which I think is where I've got to in my allyship, is not quite there yet in these, especially the elite universities with big paywalls. So there's a lot of talk about paywalls. I really like that. And this Academy of Management conference has a paywall. I mean, it costs a lot of money to go to it, let alone travel to it. So it's quite an elite group of people who attend, and I acknowledge that.
Mm. I'm learning. I've just restarted my learning journey in Te Reo, and I'm going through this section at the moment about he, she, which is ear. There's no he or she. It's just kind of they, but that specific person. Mm-hmm. And then I just was reminded of that when you were talking before about how we need to get rid of this focus on gender as being a determinant in anything, really. How do we do that, Steve?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of white men who have to get over themselves. That would help, because there's currently some of the, you know, there's a lot of white men with power who are reluctant to let go of it. And so for me, that's significant, if there are men who are like that, they need to be challenged. But it's not up to Māori to challenge them. It's up to people like me to challenge them, right? I get that, right? And I do that more now than I ever used to, because I'm finding my voice and finding my confidence in a way. And I'm doing it in a way of, look, we're missing out if we don't have these inclusive views. I mean, we're missing out on perspective that's incredibly valuable. Do you really believe that you as an expert knows everything about, you know, and let's just look at the marginalized who operate in our culture. Yeah. We have experts believing they understand what's best for them. I mean, that is just so dated to, you know, and it's so simple now to consult and ask. And, I heard a great example today of a medical piece of medical research out of Harvard where they went and asked people what they would like, and the results were phenomenal. So this idea of healthcare around people's lives rather than their lives become centered around the healthcare. So that simple change in positioning that's making the person more agentic is just, it's a way structures can, instead of being rigid, they have to become more flexible. So this is a theme that's emerged for me, that how can our structures be flexible? And one of the lines today was, so how do we have, because we have education that fits around life rather than life that fits around education, that capable. We empower our learners to start when it suits them, to, work when it suits them, etc. They have that flexibility. A lot of these semester-based old ways of you must come to the campus, otherwise it's not real, all this sort of stuff, and the most of the teaching delivered face-to-face still despite COVID, you know, and we want you back in the classroom because it's better, is kind of the argument is losing its validity a wee bit, and people are voting with their feet. They don't like it. Yeah.
So what did we actually learn from COVID in the end?
Well, what I think we learned was that a whole lot of our systems are archaic in how they're designed, and that they've just coasted along and been allowed to sit like that without having a good old rigget bit of a shake to look at them. I mean, I'm thinking about healthcare, I'm thinking about education, I'm thinking about the way governments run. People have been forced to be more flexible and nimble. Companies have had to do that in business as well. That's what I think. And I mean, I was at a workshop yesterday where there was an Australian guy there talking about the challenge, because Australia had the longest lockdown of any country in the world, over 500 days that they had lockdown during COVID. So they're kind of still coming out of it. And they have this really big problem with people who work in government going, I don't want to go back to the office. I'm way more productive. I'm way more, and you know, there's these empty buildings being rented essentially or owned, which are like, hang on, this is not a good thing. We've got empty buildings that we don't need, but we're caught in between these business models and we don't know how to navigate this. So it's about, at the AOM conference, there's been a lot of talk about loss of control during COVID from managers who want it back. And the way they want it back in immature companies is to say, we want you in the office. It's not negotiable. We never gave you permission to leave. And the more onto it organizations are going, right, how can we reframe what we do and how can we do it better? And, you know, many are settling on 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, coming in to be face-to-face, and off you go for the other three. And that is enabling, you know, in a country like Australia where there's very high employment at the moment, apparently unemployment's the lowest it's ever been in the last 50 years in Melbourne for professional jobs. People are really able to, at interview, people are going, right, how much can I work flexibly? Oh, you can't. Oh, well, no thanks. You know, so you know, that's really useful to have these perspectives and think about that stuff for me.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi araha nui kia koutou, ko tāhoahou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars and your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last more than 3 years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the time, the space, the love, the care, the support that we all need to recover and recalibrate in this time. Now, it's exciting for me, of course, to be part of this show, and I want to give a big thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. It's really a wonderful pleasure and privilege to be here with you all, and to think about transformative learning. And of course, as a species, we are learning constantly. We have this incredible consciousness that we have evolved, and it allows us to give that gift of awareness back to nature. We are nature observing herself, himself, itself, that beautiful connection that we have with the living world, where we can gift our consciousness and our awareness back to the infinite universe that's produced it. How amazing. It's a beautiful exchange. And when we witness, of course, the beautiful array of treasures all around us, we can sense that feeling of homecoming and self-recognition, that beauty within us all. It's a beautiful, beautiful capability that we have. And of course, alongside this, we have the ability to learn so many new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling, which are really important now. and for all of us. We have been on this learning journey as long as we have been aware and alive, and you know, each of us possesses a unique consciousness, so it's a unique experience, and it's so important that we share our perceptions and our understanding so we can learn from one another. This is a beautiful capability of our species to come together and to share. And tomorrow I will be giving a talk at the University of Otago all about my heart's home workplace, Orokonui Eco Sanctuary, where I'm very lucky to have been for the last 14 years. And in this talk, I'll be sharing all the learnings and the many different triumphs and challenges that we have overcome and rejoiced in, all the species that we have returned to the Orokonui Valley that became locally extinct. And I will be encouraging the audience, which, you know, will be many beautiful, passionate conservationists, to follow their passion and their own learning, their own knowledge in this realm, and taking steps and doing what they feel is right in this environment. And of course, we're so lucky to have this beautiful paradise that we live in and learn from, constantly informed by the living world and by each other. It's a very interesting time for us all now to be alive, and there's so many new ways of existing that are coming into the world for us to sift through and exemplify if we choose. And one of those, of course, is this vision of predator-free 2050, which, you know, many of us may be able to achieve if we work together. And I feel very grateful to work in the conservation realm because it's a realm of love. And I hope for all of us we find our own realm of love to move in. And it's been lovely having this time with you today. Thanks so much. I'll talk with you again soon. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Steve Henry. Steve, you're talking about learner agency and transformation and what we do and how lots of people around the world are looking at that. Do you think it's too a bridge too far? Do they need to change wholesale to achieve that, or can they do a little bit of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the important shift that's happening, and once you pass through this glass ceiling, you kind of can't go back, and that is that we have these experts that we often defer agency to. Just think about healthcare. We trust our doctors, and you're the expert in this space. And once we do that, I'm not poo-pooing experts. We need them. I want people to engineer and design things and have more knowledge than me. But I want to have a conversation with them that enables me to, especially when I'm learning about stuff, if we have professors who become experts in the curriculum and they prescribe that and they lecture to people what they should learn, the risk of that is the learners are not as invested in it as when they are able to say, look, this is my context, this is my area of endeavor, I know the most about this context actually because I'm in it, from this cultural lens, from my workplace, so thank you, I would love your input. But don't lecture to me how to do that, please. You get what I mean? So there's a real, that's what we're doing at our workshop tomorrow, is putting that provocation out there. It's like, look, there's a lot of power given to you when you're constructing a curriculum that you assume a class of 200, it's going to land. You know, what if we flip that and have the flipped classroom, which is right. Let's work out for you what's going to work. And you can do this at scale. People are doing it. You know, you come from your lens. Let's get clear on what your lens is, what the drivers of that is, what the context is. So let's spend a lot more time on the context than we do on the subject, right? And let's meet you there. And historically, the subject's been protected by the expert as their currency and their leveraging power. And what's happening now with people being able to Google information or just find it much more easily through media, That's shifting. So people are warmed up to that idea, but what we're doing is really going, well, this is what the bridge looks like. Either cross it or you might fall down the chasm, because that's the trend that I think COVID's accelerated.
We've talked for at least 15 years about the risks, but also the potential benefits of greenwash.
Mm.
Is there an equivalent transformation wash?
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely. The language is just unbelievable. I went to Harvard today because I wanted to go. I had a couple of hours, so I caught the train out there and I just wanted to walk through the campus. And, you know, this place began in the late 1600s based on Puritan principles. And I wanted to walk around and get a sense of what it was like. And it was like going to Queenstown. It was kind of like this tourism gig, you know, people wearing T-shirts. Hey, I'm cool because I've got a Harvard T-shirt, you know, and it's just like, it was like university tourism. The brand had just kind of gone. So I was kind of found it really comical. But what really struck me was they don't have a manicured courtyard like many universities do, with people lounging on the grass. There's none of that going on. There's a whole village that's been constructed around the campus, which is like a commercial strip where you buy your lunch and you buy tourists. It's just quite fascinating. So, and you know, and all the stuff happens away from that leafy thing. So yeah, I found that fascinating to explore this myth of these Ivy League universities who are so privileged and have so much money and influence in their brand that, you know, the University of Otago, for example, has a far prettier campus with way more buildings and way more, you know, infrastructure, it would appear, on the outset. But anyway, I digress. And I mean, the coolest thing I've done at this thing was I went to a workshop about, I'm just finding the right page in my book, if I can speak to it properly, because there's so many. Yeah, it was about activism within the academy. So it's this idea of how radical activity within teaching in the business school context mostly. And so people were coming and talking about, I mean, a woman from Pakistan, she has a whole lot of learners in her university who've never cleaned a toilet in their life and they're in their 20s, right? So she does an activity with her class where they go and clean a toilet and then reflect on what it's meant to them. And she's written a thing on the biopolitics of toilet cleaning. I mean, she's done academic research around that, because there's such a class system that you know, how can people have... So we started talking about experience. And, you know, in my own experience, you know, I've taken learners to places where there's composting toilets only, and how confronting that was, you know, for them to not have what they expect, especially middle class people who were wanting to learn about sustainability but weren't interested in composting at all, okay, you know, because it was too confronting. So we had some very rich conversations about that. And another guy who... He's from the Czech, but he's lived in Turkey, New Zealand, and the Netherlands. And he looks at this concept of activist performity, which is aligning research, teaching, activism. And he talks about having a critical pedagogy around teaching, i.e. looking to have change, with the knowledge, critical knowledge, but then having social impact. So measuring that social impact in partnership with organisations who are attempting to make change is what their curriculum is about. So people are they're in real life projects. You know, they're not in the lecture theatre. So I do think there is a definite thing that the people who were out of the lecture theatres, people were having experiences that they were learning from. And the people here who were facilitating those experiences could see. And I went to a workshop today, for example, where I learned about a doctorate student who'd put himself in prison for 9 months to have the experience of being in a prison, and to be able to reflect and write about that experience from the prisoner's lens. And talking to the person who's supervising and mentoring him, it's 3 years since he was in prison, and he still hasn't got back from being in prison. It's just been such a massive experience. It's changed him. So I was imagining doing that as an embedded piece of autoethnography, right? Having the experience of that. And no one else knew that was the case, so only he was dealing with that. What a thing, eh? like, how do you, I said to him, how do you get that through an ethics committee? And he said, oh, we don't have those. They just trust what we do. And I'm like, wow. You know, you wouldn't get that through an ethics committee in New Zealand, I don't reckon. Right? So a lot of fascination around stuff like that, which happened in conversations. I mean, another person from Brazil using movies, song, and poetry to engage learners around meaning making. And they would deconstruct their favorite film, song, and poem at undergraduate level to make sense, to do an ethnography and create essentially what we do at Capable, a portfolio of their learning around this deconstruction. Now, that's a really cool idea, right? I mean, imagine doing that for film in Aotearoa, Mawira, you know, and what it would mean to look at Reservoir Dogs or, you know, some of our other iconic confronting Once Were Warriors films, which have really Moana, you know, translated into Te Reo now, and show Taka Waititi being interviewed saying, oh, don't get me on again to talk about Indigenous bloody stuff, please. We're too busy. Just do it yourself. You know, I'm tired of being consulted about, you know, I mean, the learning of that's phenomenal, right? So I do think there's something happening around the bridging of seeing learning, the experience beyond the lecture theatre in these schools, which are very traditional. There's people doing that stuff.
Let's squeeze in the second of your music choices. What have we got?
Les Miserables.
Yeah, let's do that. Why this one?
Well, I'm coming home in a couple of days, and it just feels very symbolic for me to bring it all together and bring it home. And the meaning in this song's immense about belonging and feeling like you care and you want to make a difference.
God on high, my prayer, in my need, you have always been there. Easy Jim rest heaven blessed bring him home. He's like the sun I might have known if God had granted me a son. The sun has died one by one, how soon they fly on and on, and I am old and will be gone. Bring him peace, bring him joy. He is young.
Steve, it sounds like you are coming home with a pocket full of richness. What have the gems been from your trip?
Well, you know, I'm definitely coming home reframing my practice. There's no doubt about it. And I've just been so animated and activated by all the experience. And I'm coming home with more questions than answers. And, you know, one of the questions was, right, can I be honest with my boss?
Oh.
Right, that was a really good confrontation, you know, a provocation from a workshop I was at today. And, you know, how honest am I prepared to be with my boss? Because that's how much psychological safety is there in this? So this woman from Harvard was on about this, about, let's be honest, you know, is it 50%? Is it 60, 80, 90? And so I've got that question's very alive. I love the thing about being limited by paywalls. I'm very proud of the Open Education Resource University, Sam, that you remember we wrote a paper for around sustainable development. And I was able to share that with a whole lot of learners from Kenya and other places and just say, look, this is free, this stuff. Get into it. And so, you know, I think there are ways beyond the paywalls. I've reinterpreted my doctorate data, all of it, and I kind of have realized that the learner transformation, which has been the phenomena that I've been examining, is because of a passion. There's some drive and motivation for sense making, which is what it's about. So this idea of drive is new for me. I've always known it was a, you know, what's this force? What's the motivation or the calling or this activating force to have agency? So that's become more clear for me. Focus on the shortfalls, not the gap. I like that. So instead of this classic, what's the gap in the literature? It's like, well, hang on, what are the shortfalls in our practice? Because you can't really have gaps in practice the way you can from a theoretical point of view. But so that's the thing that's quite alive for me. And for me, my drive is around inclusion. It always has been. So that's what's very alive. The fact that I've been hanging out with these Jungian, these Canadians are all Jungian geeks. So they're really into humans' search for meaning. That's what they do. And, you know, we're humans searching for meaning. That's essentially what we're doing. And when you interact with systems, you can't interact with the straight lines, it's not linear. So, you know, when you have system flexibility, that's good. I kind of learned about AI a lot, went to a few workshops around AI, and it was very much you need to do research around AI out in the field. You can't do it theoretically. It just doesn't work. So go and, you know, it's not helpful that AI is being hyped up. This is what the AI researchers were saying. And they were also saying that, one of the things we could do around AI to make it a heap better is to use it to see patterns that we can't. Feed your data in there, have a look. Let it look in places that you don't usually look. I like that. That's a real gem for me. Permissionless organizations learn faster. So if you're waiting to get approval to do something, it's going to be slower. The harder I try, the luckier I get. Mark Twain. And systemic use of AI will enable more serendipity. So you're more likely to have chances of things occurring if you can use AI to lower the cost of cognition and connection, basically. I quite like that. Say it again, AI can lower the cost of cognition and connection. So there's less time needed to think about stuff, and we can also use it to work out how to connect better. I quite like that. And final one, find the adjacent possible. So, Maui, I'll use you as an example, my relationship with you. You know, you're a Maori woman who you're an adjacent possible with me, because I can check with you around whether I'm being a good ally or not, right?
Yeah.
So you're a way for me to test if actually the story I'm telling myself about becoming a better ally is real or not. You know, is this going to serve from your Maori lens? Does that make sense? And I have other people I can ask who are Maori about that too. And the adjacent possible. That's a great thought, isn't it? So where we overlap with someone in our practice, that's where we can then ask for some way to enter their world a wee bit more. So it's relational.
That relies so heavily on the depth of honesty and integrity within the relationship, doesn't it? And that's right. What you were talking about earlier. That still comes down to the depth of the relationship, the strength of it.
So I believe now, next time I go and teach a research bootcamp, I'm going to spend 90% of the time on culture and context,
yeah,
and 10% on doing research.
Yes.
I mean, at the end of what we did in the end of the last day is we just lined people up on a continuum from being positivist to constructivism right down to, you know, critical researchers. And on that line, we said, right, go stand where you are. And most people, and where have you walked? And of course, all the facilitators were there have walked right across all those lines on that continuum. But these people who are younger have one fixed position and they think that's it.
Yeah.
And we were able to help them see that, look, when you've navigated some of these contexts already in your life, you know, when have you believed in science very strictly and you know, whether you've believed in antibiotics or not, they've probably worked.
Yeah.
Etc. You know, so it's a really fascinating thing to play with. So yeah, it's been very rich. Really appreciate the opportunity to come and have a chat with you. It's helped me distill and crystallize what I've learned from my trip.
Let's quickly go through the questions to end the show with. You've had all these before. So what's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years, Steve?
Couple of years. Oh, getting over my old story of being important.
What's your superpower?
Being brave to dare to be vulnerable and connect people through authenticity.
Are you an activist?
Absolutely.
What for?
For transformation of the tertiary education sector and inclusion.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
A sense that education could be so much more than what it is right now in our formal context. I believe it's just tapping at the potential of what it can do given its resourcing.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
Articulating this in a way that people don't get threatened and can see that there's value and being willing to experiment. Articulating that in the form of meaningful dialogue with others through video, writing, conversation. I've been marginalized mostly by my own story, I think, over time, and I'm learning to, and like coming to this big conference has made me realize I'm a part of this academic community. So maybe I've had reluctance to accept that I'm an academic.
And articulating it in a thesis would be a good start.
That's a good place to go. That's a good idea.
Let's do that. And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Oh, I wouldn't dare. Be you. Find your own unique way to be your perspective and communicate it and be brave. Yeah. Because it's valuable. It's valid. It's valid.
Thank you for that. Mawira.
Steve, it is a joy to be on the Change team with you. Always has been from the first day that I met you. And I really appreciate your willingness to be so open, the way that you share and how centered your sharing and your feeling of success and what you've just gained is on how that can then impact your practice area. I love that about you. It's not just about you, it's about everybody, and it's about all those intersections in your life, and that makes you a really special person. Thank you for sharing with us today. Safe journey home, and I look forward to our next cup of tea. Kia ora.
Oh, kia ora, Maria. Thank you for that honouring. It's very kind. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Steve. See you soon.
Hey, good one, guys. It's 9 o'clock at night. Time to watch some sport before sleep.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic Te Pūkenga. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This is George Winston and Meryl Streep's take on The Velveteen Rabbit. I'm Samuel Mann in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, with Mawira Karatai in Whakatane, and joining us today from Boston has been our colleague, Steve Henry. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wā.
The skin horse had lived longer in the nursery than any of the others. He was so old that his brown coat was bald in patches and showed the seams underneath, and most of the hairs in his tail had been pulled out to string bead necklaces. He was wise, for he had seen a long succession of mechanical toys arrive to boast and swagger, and by and by break their mainsprings and pass away. He knew that they were only toys, and would never turn into anything else. For nursery magic is very strange and wonderful, and only those playthings that are old and wise and experienced, like the skin horse, understand all about it. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with."
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.